And this is Focus 580. It's 11:07 on a Monday morning. My name is Les Schulte. I'm the Director of Corporate Support here at WILL, filling in for David Inge this morning. And it's not often they let the guys from the back room up this far in front of the building. So if it's time for you to make a call right now, if you have questions concerning women's health, Dr. Suzanne Troopen is with us. She owns the women's health practice here in Champaign, and she is also on the staff of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Illinois. Dr. Troopen, thank you very much for being with us again this morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And to get things started, is there anything on the top of your mind you'd like to talk about first?
Well, in the summer, as we're all trying to wiggle into our bathing suits, we thought we'd talk a little bit about fats and important fats that are good for us. There has been a lot of new research about how important the omega-3 fatty acids are for the health of both moms and babies, and it's good for men in terms of prevention of heart disease as well. And in pregnancy in recent years, we've actually told our patients to limit their fish intake because of mercury levels of our fish. So they actually are told to specifically limit fish intake. And fish and fish oil is actually a very important source of these important compounds, the omega-3 fatty acids. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about those.
Okay. If you'd like to, if you have a specific question you'd like to ask Dr. Troopen about women's health issues or health issues you may be call 217-244 nine. Whoops, I'm giving the pledge number. That's the number they usually let me give. The Focus 580 number is 217-333-9455. Or if you're out of the area, 800-222-9455. All of our phone lines are open right now, so you can get right through. And our guest this morning, as she is every month, is Dr. Suzanne Troopen. And Doctor, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Well, we have we talk a lot about the polyunsaturated fats as some of the favorable fats, and there are different polyunsaturated fats, and some are the omega-9s, which aren't so good for us, but both the omega-3s and 6s probably are both good for us, but omega-3 fatty acids are some of the most important compounds that we can get into our system, particularly when we're pregnant. And babies have important brain and retinal development from these omega-3 fatty acids. And in moms, it helps to prevent preterm birth. There's some evidence that in diabetics, it helps to prevent complications of diabetes. And there's some evidence that omega-3 fatty acids also help to prevent heart disease in both pregnant moms and, of course, all of the rest of us. So we spend a lot of time telling moms how to eat, and you can get omega-3 fatty acids, particularly the DHA. DHA and is probably the most important one that there is out there. And actually, some eggs are fortified with DHA. So like with other nutrients, we rely a lot on fortification, just like with our pregnant moms, we talk about getting enough folic acid, but we actually have about at least 100 micrograms per serving of pasta or grains or rice of folic acid. And DHA is this omega-3 that's also supplemented in some eggs. And we think that adults probably need 200 to 300 milligrams a day of DHA, and probably in average American diets, we may only get 5 to 30. We may get really small amounts.
Really?
Now, in kales and spinach and some of the green leafy vegetables that not all of us do eat in our diet, we sometimes will get adequate levels. And if you eat a big serving of fish, you can probably get an adequate level also. But that's probably what we need. In terms of why it might help to prevent preterm birth, we know that in preterm birth is a condition that is very problematic and rising in the United States. So that about 1 in 10 deliveries was born prematurely back in 90, and the last time they ran the statistics, it was about 1 in like 12%. So it crept up even from the 1 in 10 rate. Now, in the United States, we have a lot of confusion with our statistics because what has happened is there are conditions that we've been able to actually treat and prolong the pregnancy from a stage that would be considered a miscarriage to a stage that would be considered a viable preterm birth. So that's actually a good thing. It raised the preterm birth rate, but actually perhaps got a successful pregnancy from a pregnancy that wasn't successful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I tell you what, we've got a couple of calls on the line. Let's go ahead and see what people have on their minds this morning. Good morning. Line one, Champaign, you're on the air with Dr. Troopin.
Good morning. My question is, I had breast cancer in October. I had a mastectomy, and I've heard I didn't choose to have reconstructive surgery. And I've heard a lot of people say that you must wear a prosthesis if you don't do reconstructive surgery because otherwise it would do bad things to your spine. So I just wondered if that's like a wives' tale or if that's a true and real thing.
Wow. I'm sorry. I've never actually heard anybody say that about a prosthesis. Now, in terms of spine health, there's no doubt about it that proper posture is important. Weight bearing can be a problem. Some women with massively heavy breasts to begin with, whether or not they've had surgery, et cetera, can actually have such heaviness that their posture is slumped over and that it predisposes a curvature of the spine. If we develop osteoporosis and if from that osteoporosis we develop an osteoporotic fracture of the spine, what we typically get are these what they call wedge fractures, so that instead of a vertebral column looking like a box, it looks like a wedge with the smaller part being forward and the larger parts usually in the back. And with that, it predisposes to that arch that some people get with very, very poor osteoporotic spines. And we call it dorsal kyphosis, and then they end up getting what's called lumbar lordosis. So the upper part of the back is humped. That's the kyphosis. And the lower part of the back, actually, depending the way the spine is, kind of juts forward, and you get a spinal deformity. Now, whether a amount of scoliosis would affect this, or a twisting of the spine, or an imbalance of the musculature of one side versus the other, I know there can be subtle effects, but exactly how dramatic those effects would be is probably beyond the scope of my knowledge. It'd have to be something I'd have to check.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Let's go to line two. In Champaign, you're on the air with the doctor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You mentioned that omega-9 fatty acids might not be so good. Could you tell me what oils contain those?
Well, most of the fats that we eat are very high, like the fats that are for French fries and some of the fats on meat, the kinds of things that we get in our diet might have some omega-9s. Also, omega-9 can be produced by our body. Omega-3 and 6 can't be. So when you get fat in, or even a high diet, like a diabetic with high blood sugar, by the time her body is busy producing the effects that it produces in response, your body can produce the omega-9s.
She cooks with cottonseed oil and likes peanut oil. Are they okay?
Well, with your overall, I think cottonseed and peanut oil in small amounts for cooking would be fine. But if you're doing a lot of deep fat frying, you could cause an overall imbalance in the amount of fat in your body. And for most Americans to really get the proper omega-3, we're starting to think in terms of supplementation. And there are more and more products that the omega-3s are being supplemented into, like for my field, we have prenatal vitamins that are supplemented with omega-3. There are sometimes nutrient bars that have omega-3s, and there's actually supplements you can buy for omega-3s and fish oil tabs that has omega-3s.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you very much. The numbers to call locally, 333-9455, or if you're out of the area, you can call toll-free 800-244-9455 if you have a question for Dr. Suzanne Troopen this morning. Just sort of in general, Doctor, it is summertime. We're going, I guess, officially start summer tomorrow, I think. And speaking of diets, do things change in the summertime, or should they change in the summertime as far as women and their what they eat?
Well, briefly, we were talking about vitamin D, which is a nutrient that we can get in when we're exposed to sun. But, of course, as you were saying, most of the dermatologists tell you to lather up pretty good on those sunscreens, and using sunscreen and staying indoors will actually dramatically reduce the amount of vitamin D that you will get naturally into your system. So if you normally take vitamin D supplements, but in the summer you're going to spend a lot of time outside, and if you aren't using the very thick, high-powered SPF sunscreens, you could actually possibly reduce the amount of vitamin D into your diet, but it would probably be hard to get too much vitamin D, or the amount of toxicity with the amounts we usually recommend would be far off, so it would be safe to stay on it if you didn't want to reduce it. We usually talk in terms of increased water, and we've always told everyone to get 10 glasses of water a day, but there's actually been some studies lately that not everybody does need that amount of water, and many people can be perfectly healthy with less. But if you are dehydrated, that will alter your sodium and potassium as well, and it can predispose you to muscle cramps. So staying well hydrated is important for that, and that's why the sports drinks actually replace some electrolytes as well, because when we sweat, we do sweat off a little bit of sodium and potassium as well.
So, I have heard you can get too much water. Is that right?
There's a medical term for it, but it would be a situation where you get your blood so dilute that the levels of iron in your blood, because of the dilution, could go down. The levels of these chemical factors in your blood could go down as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it is possible to get too much.
But you'd have to be drinking a lot of water, right?
You would have to be drinking a lot of water. Most of my patients who consume a lot of fluid, it's not water that's the offending product. It's usually carbonated pops.
Right. Let's go back to the phone. Line one from Terre Haute. You're on the air with the doctor.
Hi.
Hi.
Dr. Troopen, I am 33 years old and have two lovely children, and my husband and I have decided that we're done. We don't want to have any more children, and I'm considering a tubal ligation. Can you tell me a little bit about the procedure and what the recovery looks like?
Okay, excellent question. Well, the standard tubal ligation in the United States has been a laparoscopic fulguration, and that's basically a fancy term for a laparoscopic procedure. Some people call it belly button surgery because usually there's a telescope inserted through about a quarter inch incision at the base of the belly button, and to look in at the uterus tubes and ovaries, and then a second incision of the same size is usually put just above the pubic bone, so right at the lower part of your abdomen, and that secondary site is where the instrument to actually perform the tubal ligation is placed, and the tube is usually grasped with a cauterizing instrument and cauterized, and the failure rate for that is about 3 per 1,000 if you look out over 10 years. But of the women who quote unquote fail, some are tubal pregnancies, some are miscarriages, so the failure rate in terms of babies is probably significantly lower than that. And it's a very safe, quick procedure. Most physicians would perform the operation in the range of 15 to 30 minutes, depending if there was anything else going on. Sometimes they encounter little bits of endometriosis or scar tissue or something like that to handle, so that might extend the operation. But the operation itself is very quick. Because of the nature of the operation, you don't have to be so heavy under anesthesia to tolerate it. So usually the amounts of anesthesia are very modest, and many of the anesthetics that we use have reversants. And so you wake up fairly quickly. Most people will then walk around, have a little bit something to drink after their surgery, and be discharged in about an hour. Most women will take a day or two off after their surgery, and it's effective immediately. It's more costly than, say, a male partner having a vasectomy. Vasectomy is always done under local anesthesia, and it's about as rapid. And the difference is vasectomies aren't effective the day you leave the doctor's office. It takes about 6 weeks for the entire sperm production that's left over to go away and to be effectively sterile. But the success rates are about the same as tubal ligations. Now, there is a new procedure that many of us who do this procedure predict will sort of take over the female sterilization, and that procedure is called the E-Sure procedure. And basically, it is a set of coils that are inserted in the uterotubal junction. So the physician puts in a speculum, they use a device to hold your, stabilize your cervix. You usually get some numbing medicine locally, and we look inside the uterus with a telescope and place these little coils in where the tube comes into the uterus, one on each side. And it can be a very simple, quick procedure. It can be in the range of 6 to 10 minutes, and it would be unusual to take too much longer than that. So you can get it performed under general anesthesia as well, which, you know, would have the same sort of hour recovery time, but most patients just do it under local anesthesia. It is not guaranteed effective the day those coils are inserted. You usually go in for an X-ray study 3 months later to make sure that the little coils have now sealed themselves into the junction between the uterus and the tube. And with that, you're then sterile. And it's pretty much 100% effective. And basically, really, the case reports where both coils are shown to be there at the 3 month X-ray. I think in the original studies there were no pregnancies. Now, if the coils dislodged or one coil couldn't be inserted, that's a different story. We think that the disadvantage of that is that it's really designed to be very permanent. And while a tubal sterilization with the laparoscopy and the cautery is designed to be permanent, a test tube baby could be done. There's nothing different about your uterus. Now, there have really been almost no reported pregnancies with those coils, so it'd be hard for a physician to recommend getting in vitro fertilization baby after the E-Sure. But the E-Sure is so quick and simple. I think it's really a great choice. And then the other choice is to consider a Paragard IUD. And the Paragard IUDs are good for 10 years. And so you get that IUD popped in, you're good for 10 years. So a lot of women coming in their late 30s, early 40s, that's going to take them pretty close to menopause. And actually in Europe, they use them for 12 years. So you can get very close to the amount of pregnancy protection time. And once an IUD has been in, usually if it's going to fall out, it falls out right away. So you take those people out of the statistics, the IUD effectiveness level gets awfully close to sterilization after that first year when the failures come out of the formula. But there are a lot of good choices. Many of my patients start by checking with their insurance company to see what is covered. E-Sure just got its CPT code in the fall, which means that it's so new that not every insurance company has gotten on the bandwagon yet with covering it. That'll be something that your doctor's office could certainly help you with.
Okay. Thank you for the info.
Thanks a lot for the call. It's 11:26, and you are listening to Focus 580. My name is Les Schulte. I'm filling in for David Inge this morning. David will be back tomorrow morning. And our guest this morning is Dr. Suzanne Troopen, and she is with us once a month. She is on the staff at the University of Illinois in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and she also owns the Women's Health Practice here in Champaign. And, Doctor, we've talked, and I should mention the lines are open right now. If you have a call and would like to have a question for Dr. Troopen, call 333-9455. If you're out of the area, the toll-free number is 800-222-9455, and we'll get you right on the air. But while we're waiting, Doctor, we talked a little bit about pregnancy, but let's talk a little bit about the other side of the age scale. And you had mentioned women closing in on menopause. And one of the things that affects of menopause is bone loss. What can women do to help prevent bone loss as they enter the years of menopause?
Well, we have to start early. We accrue the majority of our bone in our teens and 20s, and we actually probably into our early 30s, most of us are still accruing some bone mass. But already starting in our 40s, we tend to start losing bone. So we lose about 0.5% a year in our 40s, and then once we go into menopausal time, we lose 2-4% of bone per year, and then that stabilizes out to a 1-2% loss over time, which is about what men as they age will lose as well. So part of that is due to calcium problems. Part of that is due to the vitamin D. Vitamin D is the nutrient that allows us to absorb our calcium. And we were briefly talking about sunshine, but other ways of getting vitamin D is in supplementation. And it's been such a problem for women in that age group that even one of the most popular osteoporosis medicines, Fosamax, has just come out with a version that's supplemented with vitamin D. And I do a lot of research studies on osteopenia, which is a little bit of bone loss, and osteoporosis as well, which is a greater degree of bone loss. And for entry into our studies, we have to do sophisticated vitamin D blood testing, which isn't usually done at routine doctor's visits. And I have been very dismayed about how many of my patients have not qualified to be into our studies because of inadequate vitamin D levels. But it is a bigger problem in those of us that live in the north and aren't outside as much. And if your diet isn't quite as good, it's a problem as well. Also, for healthy bones, we know that we need vitamin E and vitamin K. And vitamin E ties into the fish oil story, because oils often are good and have adequate levels of vitamin E as well. And yet probably supplementation with E can be important for bone health. But once we enter menopause, we lose the hormonal signal for that calcium to go into bone. And it's very heavily genetic based, but still, many of us, if we live long enough, will at least get into the osteopenia range. And many of us, even if we won't test in the osteoporotic range as we age, are at increased risk for bone fractures. So that that getting that adequate calcium and vitamin D is very important, but also getting medicine to help us replace what we're losing in the way of hormonal signals to preserve our bone. And then, of course, the other very, very important piece is exercise. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, we've talked about weight-bearing exercise, but there have been some studies that show that even swimming, with the amount of exercise and the amount of muscular work that your body does, it does help your bones. Actually, being overweight makes your bones actually work harder. I know we're always struggling to find the benefits of being overweight, but it's not universally true, but it is true. We know that, for instance, they say astronauts wobble when they come off their missions, because they are in a weightless environment, and so they have zero weight bearing for these long periods of time, and they lose a significant amount of their skeleton. Mm-hmm. I think they lose at a great rater than even when we lactate and breastfeed.
Mm-hmm. Because of the weightlessness, right?
Yes.
Yep. Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, you're on the air. You're from Marshall.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You're coming back to oils and omega-3 and all. Using Enova oil in your cooking, because it doesn't put pounds on you. What do you think of it?
Oh, that's a good question, and I haven't read the label lately, and I don't remember how much they supplement back, but you'd have to read the label to see how much omega-3 is in that, but good question.
It does have vitamin E, 30%.
Yeah, it must have some... it must have some. That might be such a sophisticated question. I might even call the makers. There's got to be an 800 number on there. They would probably know.
Yeah, they've got soybean oil.
Well,
canola oil.
Yeah, canola has omega-3.
Vitamin E and vitamin C. Palmitate.
Yeah. Yeah, then it should. It definitely should.
Uh-huh. Okay. Just curious what you thought of it. Thank you.
Well, the American Heart Association has been pushing the FDA to make a statement and state that omega-3 is specifically indicated for the prevention of heart disease, because they have done some studies showing that with cultures that eat so much omega-3, their rate of cardiovascular disease and death from heart attacks and so forth is a fraction of what ours is. But I don't think they've quite gone that far. I don't know when they were going to rule on it.
Okay, interesting. 11:33, and you're listening to Focus 580 on a Monday morning. Our guest this morning is Dr. Suzanne Troopen, and she is here to answer questions that you might have about women's health care, health issues. Feel free to give us a call at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's our toll-free line if you're out of the area. Doctor, if I can sort of backtrack just a little bit.
Sure.
Daughter, who's 30 years old, was down for Father's Day from Chicago, where she lives, and she was talking about a friend of hers who's probably about moments away from having her first child. So we were talking a lot about pregnancy and delivery and all that kind of stuff. But she had brought up the fact that she was thinking of using a doula, a professional what's the term I'm looking for?
Birth attendant, or birth assistant is really what they are.
Right,
like
or birth coach, I guess, is what
sure.
How she explained it to me. What's the role of a that's something when my children were born, I guess we didn't even think about or you didn't even consider.
Now, when your children were born, we tried to shove the fathers out there into the waiting room to pace.
Yes, you did.
That was their job.
I forced my way in, by the way.
but for many years after that, we've involved the father as the primary coach. And at the same time all this has been going on, we've liberalized a lot of our birthing practices in terms of what the labor and delivery nurses do. And I honestly believe that a good labor and delivery nurse does much of what the doulas have been doing in the past. And also with the reintroduction of midwifery into the practice of obstetrics in the United States, with the midwives being there in attendance for more of the labor, I think that has also just enhanced the amount of information and the communication between the patient and the person performing the actual birth. And doulas have a role in that they are usually hired. Mm-hmm. It costs some money, but it's usually in the range of a couple 300, maybe more in Chicago, I'm not sure. They sometimes get very involved in the prenatal visits and that sort of thing, but most doulas will primarily come for the birth itself and be with the mother and or her partner during the labor, and they are really not intended to be medical. So they're there for support, might rub somebody's back. Mm-hmm. They're there to help interpret. They're there to be a little bit of a go-between if a patient wants her needs known. In my practice, we do a fairly elaborate birth plan that we have on our website, on mm-hmm. Women's Health Practice website. If anybody ever wants it, go on the web and download it. And we encourage all our patients to download that and go through it so that we have a pretty good understanding of how she'd like to see this labor progress. And in our community, we have lots of doulas that do a very good job and also take part in many births, and some of them work by themselves, and so if you hire them, you expect that person will show up, and some of them work in groups so that if you hire the doula group, you get a doula, but you don't necessarily, you know, mm-hmm. get a specific doula. And really, I've never had anybody report a bad experience from from a doula, and I think they were so crucial in the early days of demedicalizing childbirth. And I think that for most of the births that I see, they're less crucial now because the concepts that the labor and delivery nurses have embraced are very much like what the doulas have embraced.
Mm-hmm. We when my child, our first child, was born, let's say about 30 years ago, I think I was one of the first husbands or fathers to be able to be allowed in at the particular hospital where we were at the time to be there for the birth. And it was a terrific experience. In fact, I was like massaging my wife's neck or something at the time, and I got so excited I dropped her head. My wife bounced off the table because when my daughter was born. Was a terrific experience. Do most fathers, are they present for the birth these days?
Well, many of the significant others are present at birth. Mm. Around here, we do have some rules and regulations about how many individuals we can have in rooms, but many of us have done deliveries over the years where other family members are present, and it's been an innovation in about the past 20 years that siblings can also be present. But when we have young siblings present for births, we have them attend a class beforehand so they know a little bit about what they anticipate. And, of course, the dads being present when we perform cesarean births is also a little bit new.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The numbers to call, 333-9455, or if you're out of the area, 800-222-9455 if you have a question for Dr. Troopin. And let's go to the toll-free line. Line 4 from Marshall. You're on the air.
No, it's not from Marshall, I don't think. Am I on 4?
Oh, yeah, it's still line 4. Apparently I have the wrong town.
Okay, I just have a quick question. I'll hang up and listen to the answer off the air. It's an addendum to your earlier question of the sterilization procedures that you described, which, if any, are reversible, and if more than one, the more easily reversible in case the couple changes its mind later. And I'll hang up and listen. Okay?
Okay. Well, that is a very good and very important question. Most of the recent studies show that there's about a 20% rate of regret. And interestingly, you're more likely to regret that you've been sterilized if you have children than if you never had children. It probably is somewhat related to age and socioeconomic standing and so forth. But across the board, about one-fifth of patients state that they have some degree of regret. Now, not everybody who has regret would want to act on that. And in terms of the reversibility, there are really a couple of issues. And one is whether or not the uterus is changed in any way. And with the traditional laparoscopic sterilizations, the uterus is not affected in any way, so that the uterus certainly would be able to carry a pregnancy should somebody either have her tubal operation reversed or have in vitro fertilization. The second issue is whether or not the reversal would work. And if you have a tubal sterilization, typically about 1 to 2 centimeters of about a 10 to 12 centimeter fallopian tube is destroyed. And it is possible to reopen the sealed segments and reconnect them with the microscopic surgical procedure. Very few insurance companies would cover that type of elective procedure. And those procedures are quite costly. And they have a success rate of anywhere from 20 to 70%, depending on your age and what else is going on medically, or how much of the tube was removed or how it healed and so forth. And once you get over the age of 35, it's been shown statistically that you're probably better off having in vitro fertilization, which some insurance companies might cover, some don't. but doing what's essentially a test tube baby, so you bypass the tubes and you don't have to undergo an entire operation. So that is usually what is recommended for that group. Male vasectomies are also fairly reversible. They're in our area, not a lot of physicians that do them. The physician I know that's closest to Champaign-Urbana happens to be in the Bloomington area, but there are physicians that will do them, and their success rate, it varies. It's very close to the success rates for tubal reanastomosis, but again, it, depending on your insurance company, would be probably not a covered service. So being that these reverse operations are quite expensive, very few patients are encouraged to have these procedures unless they're awfully sure.
Okay. Good question. And the time right now is 11:43. We have about 15 minutes left. If you have a question that you'd like to ask Dr. Troopen, call 333-9455. Or if you're out of the area, you can call toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest this morning is Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She's on the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine here in Champaign-Urbana. She also owns the Women's Health Practice, and she joins us once a month. This is kind of a generalized question, but what's the role of men? What role do men play in women's health as far as support when you're young and your wife is pregnant, or as we get older, as the couple ages, what should the what role does the man play?
Well, I think that it's an area that's been studied a little bit, but we've probably backed into it more than anything else. They have looked at individuals that have a significant other, and as they get older, they are healthier. They seem to have less problems with obesity, less problems with elevated blood pressure, less problems with heart attacks. There's actually some studies that show even fewer cancers and fewer other types of diseases that are immune in nature. And so perhaps just having a partner is something that is just overall beneficial. In terms of what role partners play in younger individuals' health, we often focus on the negative side. Mm-hmm. We talk about putting one at risk for pregnancy, putting one at risk for sexually transmitted diseases, which would increase the rate of infertility, chronic pelvic pain, and tubal pregnancies, and actually even cancers in the case of human papillomavirus, which is transmitted sexually and increases our rate of cervical cancer. So there's that aspect as well. In terms of psychosocial development, you know, that's an interesting question as well. About 80% of children wind up in a single parent household for some time during their life. So most of the recent studies have shown that whether or not you have one parent around or two parent around, it's probably about the same, but it's hard to separate out those groups because it's so universal anymore. And knowing what the optimum family raising situation might be has been harder to pin down. And so I think that it is harder to advise patients, and patients don't really come to physicians asking for that type of advice anyway. They come and ask you to catch the baby, but they don't ask you if it's you think it's a good idea that they have one. Uh-huh. But within realm, mm-hmm. And so that probably is something that is open to debate. There's no doubt about it that two parents can bond to an infant, but. Whether or not the bonding is changed by sharing those midnight feedings or not it's something that would have to be studied. In terms of a partner supporting another individual should a serious illness come about, I think that it's very important to have partners as well.
Mm-hmm. Should we be looking for those sort of changes that take place in life to make sure that both remain healthy? I mean, as we've talked about, diet type things and things like that to make sure that everybody is doing what they can?
When couples, when one tries to quit smoking, very often they encourage the other partner to quit smoking. When one starts to exercise, they encourage the other partner to exercise. We definitely know when you have a partner, you're more likely to have intercourse. About 43% of women entering the menopausal time will report sexual dysfunction, but of that group, a huge percentage don't have a partner. And therefore, they're not functioning as well as they would be. And so that is definitely important. Men are generally bigger, so their caloric intake can be more. So if you suddenly go from eating your caloric intake to a male's caloric intake, you're going to gain weight. And that is definitely a problem. Women's nutritional needs are very different in at certain times in their life. And one aspect we haven't talked about with nutrition would be getting enough iron. Men don't generally need a lot of supplemental iron. Even complete vegetarians who are males only need a little extra iron in their diet. But women do need quite a bit of iron in their diet. And actually up to 15% of all women have levels of menstrual bleeding that would produce anemia if they didn't get supplemental iron. So I think that the amount of iron that we need would be quite different when meal planning.
Okay. It's 11:48. We have about 10 minutes left. If you'd like to get a call in, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And we have a call from McLean County, Line 4. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question about, I'm going through menopause, and I have a question about sleep. How do you deal with sleep? It's since I've been going through menopause for about 5 years, but last October something happened. It's like I am bum tired at 9 o'clock, and if I, by the time I get ready to go to bed, maybe it's 10, 10:30, and then I'm like totally wide awake. And then, you know, I mean, talking about being up all night, sometimes I even go lay on the couch just so I don't disturb my husband. And then I fall, you know, when I start to fall asleep, then I'll come back and go to bed. You know what I mean? Anyway, so if you have any other thoughts on how to deal with menopause, it'd be wonderful to hear that.
Well, it's well known that Americans are sleep deprived. Most of us probably need 8 to 9 hours of sleep, and most of us don't even allow ourselves to get that. So that when you take an average American woman who's probably not getting the amount of sleep that she needs and put her through menopause, if she has sleep disruption secondary to menopause, it can be extraordinarily disruptive problem. And you can have mood problems and memory problems and thought processing problems. There's studies to show that you're more dangerous behind the wheel. And overall, like you say, it just makes you feel miserable. We think that there are some basics for sleep hygiene. You should always go to bed at the same time. You should always get up at the same time. Sleeping in on the weekends is not considered a good thing for overall sleep patterns and sleep hygiene. We do discourage getting caffeinated beverages in after late in the afternoon. We do also recommend that people don't eat too big of a meal close to going to bed, so, and get a reasonable amount of exercise each day. So typical what we call sleep hygiene, and there are lots of excellent medical health sources that go into more depth than I've gone into. But menopause itself, for the first part of menopause, is usually characterized by hot flashes, which come on at night. And those hot flashes are specifically known to disrupt natural sleep patterns. So not only are we actually awakened more, but we spend less time in the most restful types of sleep. And just going on hormone therapy can actually normalize some of those patterns. There are sleep medicines that can do it as well. And there's been one new sleep medicine released recently. I think they've been doing some ads that I've seen on television, but that's not going to necessarily be the right option for everyone. But for people with significant sleep disruption secondary to hot flashes, there's really no better treatment than estrogen. We've tried a lot of other therapies that help control some of the mild to moderate symptoms of menopause, things like black cohosh, which is in over-the-counter herbal preparations for menopause, but they've never been shown in any studies to normalize sleep pattern the way estrogen has been shown.
Now, if let's say a person decides not to do anything, do you get over this eventually or not?
Depends on who you are. The average person, will have about 5 to 6 years in this perimenopause time leading up to menopause, maybe a couple of years of the most severe symptoms, and then they taper off. But when we do population-based studies, there are women even in their 80s who still have symptoms. And of course, the population-based studies are skewed by the fact that many women up until this point in time have been placed on estrogen. So once we got patients on estrogen, then coming off the estrogen, they would get their symptoms when they're coming off, not during their initial menopausal time. So we really have trouble answering the question of whether that the symptoms coming off will be any easier than the symptoms immediately at menopause. But we think the answer is that probably yes. As you age, you're much less likely to get these symptoms. But in my office every day are women in their 60s, sometimes into their early 70s, who actually still are having symptoms. And most of the current research that I'm involved with right now with hormone therapy, specifically for menopausal hot flashes, is focusing on the concept that maybe less is more. So maybe we can still effectively treat these symptoms, but use lower doses of hormones, which should translate into safer. Not that it hasn't been safe. It's been extraordinarily safe. It's less safe than we thought based on our original research, but still extraordinarily safe. But we can make it even better by using lower doses. But some patients, they can't even use the lower doses. In order to get rid of those symptoms, we really have to build up the hormones in their system.
Okay.
May I ask one quick question?
Sure.
Would you, doctor, would you mind giving your office number if I wanted to call about something else?
Well, I'm at Women's Health Practice, and if you look at womenshealthpractice.com, you can either email me or it's got all our contact.
Okay. All right. You know, obviously I'm not in your county, so that's why I just asked. But that's okay. Well, it's Women's Health for your website then.
Right. womenshealthpractice.com.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call. It's 11:54. We have a couple, 2-3 minutes left. We could probably get one more call in if you'd like to ask a question of Dr. Suzanne Troopen, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. One thing you just touched on there that got me thinking a little bit, how important are routines in our lives? Going, like you say, going to bed about the same time, getting up at the same time.
Well, we think that it's really very important. And the new food pyramid was released recently, and the government talked about the amount of exercise. And my patients are shocked to learn that now we're up to recommending 30 minutes a day as the most minimal for heart health. If you want to try to lose weight and you haven't been dieting, probably a full hour of heavy exercise. But if you want to maintain your weight and not gain over time, an hour and a half, 90 minutes of exercise per day is what they recommend, which is kind of tough. Everybody just laughs because if we all had 90 extra minutes in our day, mm-hmm. we'd all be a lot happier. But they have done studies to show that these kinds of routines and building in exercise into our scheme of life actually not only increases our sleep, but it actually improves its sexual function. Mm-hmm. So that's important. There have actually been studies that show that people perform better on tests and other cognitive functions when they exercise regularly. And so I think all of those things are very, very important.
How about eating on regular
eating
times?
Eating regularly, you know, it's that's a very good question. When we've studied the food interval the most with pregnancy, and we've found that pregnant moms are supposed to eat 5 to 6 times a day, as opposed to us 3 times a day. But we should calorie load more at breakfast than we do.
Okay.
We tend to calorie load at dinner.
All right. I think we have time for one more call. Line 1 from Sheldon. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I've done a little bit of research on the internet recently. I just came across your program right now. It's very interesting. And when you're saying, and perhaps the dean, I found out that there's a difference between conjugated estrogen made from horses and bioidentical estrogens and progesterones that seem to have two totally different amounts of harm or lack of harm. And I wonder if you could address that issue.
Okay.
Can you answer that in 1 minute?
I don't think I can. You should call back next month. We're on the fourth Monday of the month, but very briefly, I could send you to menopause.org. It is the side of the North American Menopause Society, and they do have some position information on different types of estrogen, as does the FDA website has extensive information on types of estrogen. And to make a very long story extraordinarily short, we think that probably transdermal estrogens, meaning anything applied on the skin, may be safer for some patients than other patients. But in general, most medical information doesn't really back up big differences between the types of estrogens. But to go into more detail than that, I'll have to defer to next time because it's a big topic. Excellent question, though. And I would also caution some of the information on bioidentical hormones is a little overstated.
Okay. Thanks a lot. And thanks for the call, really. Next time I think you'll join us will be on July 18th at 11 o'clock for the 11 o'clock hour. Doctor, thank you very much. Our guest today has been Dr. Suzanne Troopen, and she's been talking about health issues as she does every month here at WILL on Focus 580.